The synagogue at Jerusalem University is a gleaming white structure shaped like the tent of a desert wanderer, with the same billowing lines. The redbud trees were in full bloom, and the wedding party was larger than they had planned, for apart from the immediate family, there were Deborah's colleagues from the university, Robert and some of the other boys from the squadron, Ella Kadesh, Dr. Edelman, the baby-faced eye surgeon who had worked on Deborah, Aaron Cohn, and a dozen others. After the simple ceremony, they walked through the university grounds to one of the reception rooms that David had hired. It was a quiet gathering, with little laughter or joking. The young pilots from David's old squadron had to leave early to return to base, and with them went any pretense of jollity. Deborah's mother was still not yet fully recovered, and the prospect of Deborah's departure reduced her to quiet grey weeping. Deborah tried without success to comfort her. Before he left, Dr. Edelman drew David aside. "Watch for any sign of atrophy in her eyes, any cloudiness, excessive redness, any complaints of pain, headaches. I'll watch for it. Any indications, no matter how trivial. If you have any doubts, you must write to me." "Thank you, Doctor." They shook hands. "Good luck in your new life," said Edelman. Through it all, Deborah showed iron control. But even she at last succumbed, and she and her mother and Ella Kadesh all broke down simultaneously at the departure barrier of Lod Airport and hung around each other's necks, weeping bitterly. The brig and David stood by, stiff and awkward, trying to look as though they were not associated with the weeping trio, until the first warning broadcast gave them an excuse for a brief handshake, and David took Deborah's arm and drew her gently away. They climbed the boarding ladder into the waiting Boeing without looking back. The giant aircraft took off and turned away southwards. And as always, the sensation of flight soothed David. All the cares and tensions of these last few days left on the earth behind and below. He felt a new lightness of the spirit, excitement for what lay ahead. He reached across and squeezed Deborah's arm. "Hello there, Morgan," he said. And she turned towards him and smiled happily, blindly. It was necessary to spend some time in Cape Town before they could escape to the sanctuary of Jabulani in the north. David took a suite at the Mount Nelson Hotel, and from there he was able to settle the numerous issues that had piled up in his absence. The accountants who managed his trust funds demanded 10 days of his time, and they spent it in the sitting room of the suite, poring over trust documents and accounts. In 2 years, his income had grossly exceeded his spending, and the unused portion of his income had to be reinvested. In addition, the third trust fund would soon pass to him, and there were formalities to be completed. Deborah was hugely impressed by the extent of David's wealth. "You must be almost a millionaire," she said in a truly awed voice. For that was as rich as Deborah could imagine. "I'm not just a pretty face," David agreed, and she was relieved that he could talk so lightly about his appearance. Mitzi and her new husband came to visit them in their suite. However, the evening was not a success. Although Mitzi tried to act as though nothing had changed, and though she still called him warrior, yet it was apparent that she and her feelings had altered. She was heavily pregnant, and more shapeless than David would have thought possible. It was halfway through the evening before David realized the true reason for all the reserve. At first he thought that his disfigurement was worrying them, but after Mitzi had given a half-hour eulogy of the strides that Cecil was making at Morgan Group and the immense trust that Paul Morgan had placed in him, Cecil had asked innocently, "Are you thinking of joining us at the group? I'm sure we could find something useful for you to do, ha ha ha." David could assure them quietly, "No, thank you. No. You won't have to worry about me, Cecil, old boy. You take over from Uncle Paul, with my blessing." "Good Lord, I didn't mean that." Cecil was shocked, but Mitzi was less devious. "He really will be very good, warrior, and you never were interested, were you?" After that evening, they did not see the couple again. And Paul Morgan was in Europe, so David fulfilled his family obligations without much pain or suffering, and he could concentrate on the preparations for the move to Jabulani. Barney Fenter spent a week with them in choosing a suitable aircraft to handle the bush airstrip, and yet give David the type of performance he enjoyed. At last, they decided on a twin-engine Piper Navajo, a six-seater with two big 300-horsepower Lycoming engines and a tricycle undercart. And Barney walked around it with his hands on his hips. "Well, she's no mirage." He kicked the landing wheel and then checked himself and glanced quickly at David's face. "I've had enough of mirages," David told him. "They bite." On the last day, David drove out with Deborah to a farm near Pahl. The owner's wife was a dog breeder, and when they went down to the kennels, one of her Labrador pups walked directly to Deborah and placed a cold nose on her leg as he inhaled her scent. Deborah squatted and groped for his head, and after fondling for a few moments, she in her turn leaned forward and sniffed the pup's fur. "He smells like old leather," she said. "What color is he?"
"Black," said David. "Black as a Zulu."
"That's what we'll call him," said Deborah. "Zulu."
"You want to choose this one?" David asked.
"No," Deborah laughed. "He chose us." When they flew northwards the next morning, the pup was indignant at being placed in the back seat, and with a flying, scrambling leap, he came over Deborah's shoulder and took up position in her lap, which seemed to suit them both very well.
"Looks like I have competition," David muttered ruefully.
From the brown plateau of the Highveld, the land dropped away steeply down the escarpment to the bushveld of southern Africa. David picked up his landmark on the little village of Bushbuck Ridge and the long, slim snake of the Sabi River as it twisted through the open forests of the plain. He altered course slightly northwards, and within 10 minutes he saw the low line of blue hills which rose abruptly out of the flat land. "There it is, ahead of us," David told Deborah, and his tone was infectious. She hugged the dog closer to her and leaned towards David. "What does it look like?" The hills were forested with big timber and turreted with grey rock. At their base, the bush was thick and dark. The pools glinted softly through the dark foliage. He described them to her. "My father named them the String of Pearls, and that's what they look like. They rise out of the runoff of rainwater from the sloping ground beyond the hills. They disappear just as suddenly again into the sandy earth of the plain," David explained as he circled the hills, slowly losing height. "They were what gave Jabulani its special character, for they provided water for all the wildlife of the plain. Birds and animals are drawn from hundreds of miles to the pearls." He leveled out and throttled back, letting the aircraft sink lower. "There's the homestead. White walls and thatch to keep it cool in the hot weather, deep shaded verandas and high rooms. You'll love it." The airstrip seemed clear and safe, although the windsock hung in dirty tatters from its pole. David circled it carefully before lining up for the landing, and they taxied towards the small brick hangar set amongst the trees. David kicked on the wheel brakes and cut the engines.
"This is it," he said.
Jabulani was one of the block of estates that bounded the Kruger National Park, the most spectacular nature reserve on Earth. These estates were not productive, in that they were unsuitable for the growth of crops, and few of them were used for grazing of domestic animals. Their immense value lay in the unspoiled bushveld and the wildlife, in the peace and space upon which wealthy men placed such a premium that they would pay large fortunes for a piece of this Lebensraum. When David's grandfather had purchased Jabulani, he had paid a few shillings an acre, for in those days the wilderness was still intact. It had been used as a family hunting estate down the years, and as Paul Morgan had never shown interest in the veld, it had passed to David's father and so to David. Now the 18,000 acres of African bush and plain, held as freehold land, was a possession beyond price. Yet the Morgan family had made little use of it these last 15 years. David's father had been an enthusiastic huntsman, and with him most of David's school holidays had been spent here. However, after his father's death, the visits to Jabulani had become shorter and further apart. It was 7 years since the last visit, when he had brought up a party of brother officers from Cobra Squadron. Then it had been immaculately run by Sam, the black overseer, butler, and game ranger. Under Sam's management, there had always been fresh, crisp linen on the beds, highly polished floors,
The exterior walls of the buildings had been snowy white, and the thatch neat and well tended. The deep freeze had been well stocked with steak, and the liquor cupboard filled, with every bottle accounted for. Sam ran a tight camp, with half a dozen willing and cheerful helpers. "Where is Sam?" was the first question David asked of the two servants who hurried down from the homestead to meet the aircraft. "Is Sam gone?" "Where to?" And the answer was the eloquent shrug of Africa. Their uniforms were dirty and needed mending, and their manners disinterested. "Where's the Land Rover?" "Is she is dead." They walked up to the homestead, and there David had another series of unpleasant surprises. The buildings were dilapidated, looking forlorn and neglected under their rotting black thatch. The walls were dingy, grey-brown, with the plaster falling away in patches. The interiors were filthy with dust, and sprinkled with the droppings of the birds and reptiles that had made their homes in the thatch. The mosquito gauze, that was intended to keep the wide verandas insect-free, was rusted through and breaking away in tatters. The vegetable gardens were overgrown, the fences about them falling to pieces. The grounds of the homestead itself were thick with rank weed, and not only the Land Rover had died. No single piece of machinery on the estate, water pump, toilet system, electricity generator, motor vehicle, was in working order. "It's a mess. A frightful mess," David told Deborah, as they sat on the front step and drank mugs of sweet tea. Fortunately, David had thought to bring emergency supplies with them. "Oh, Davy, I'm so sorry, because I like it here. It's peaceful, so quiet. I can just feel my nerves untying themselves."
"Don't be sorry, I'm not. These old huts were built by Gramps back in the 20s, and they weren't very well built even then." David's voice was full of new purpose, a determination that she had not heard for so long. "It's a fine excuse to tear the whole lot down and build again."
"A place of our own?" she asked.
"Yes," said David delightedly. "That's it, that's just it."
They flew into Nelspruit, the nearest large town, the following day. In the week of bustle and planning that followed, they forgot their greater problems. With an architect, they planned the new homestead with care, taking into consideration all their special requirements. A large, airy study for Deborah, workshop and office for David, a kitchen laid out to make it safe and easy for a blind cook, rooms without dangerous split levels and with regular, easily learned shapes, and finally a nursery section. When David described this addition, Deborah asked cautiously,
"You making some plans that I should know about?"
"You'll know about it all right," he assured her.
The guest house was to be separate and self-contained and well away from the main homestead, and the small hutment for the servants was a quarter of a mile beyond that, screened by trees and the shoulder of the rocky koppie that rose behind the homestead. David bribed a building contractor from Nelspruit to postpone all his other work, load his workmen on four heavy trucks, and bring them out to Jabulani. They began on the main house, and while they worked, David was busy resurfacing the airstrip, repairing the water pumps and such other machinery as still had life left in it. However, the Land Rover and the electricity generator had to be replaced. Within 2 months, the new homestead was habitable, and they could move. Deborah set up her tape recorders beneath the big windows overlooking the shaded front garden, where the afternoon breeze could cool the room and waft in the perfume of the frangipani and poinsettia blooms. While David was completely absorbed in making Jabulani into a comfortable home, Deborah made her own arrangements. Swiftly, she explored and mapped in her mind all her immediate surroundings. Within weeks, she could move about the new house with all the confidence of a person with normal sight, and she had trained the servants to replace each item of furniture in its exact position. Always, Zulu, the Labrador pup, moved like a glossy black shadow beside her. Early on, he had decided that Deborah needed his constant care and had made her his life's work. Quickly, he learned that it was useless staring at her or wagging his tail. To attract her attention, he must whine or pant. In other respects, she was also slightly feeble-minded.
The only way to prevent her doing stupid things like falling down the front steps or tripping over a bucket left in the passage by a careless servant was to bump her with his shoulder or with his nose. She had fallen readily into a pattern of work that kept her in her workroom until noon each day, with Zulu curled at her feet. David set up a large bird bath under the trees outside her window, so the tape she made had as a background the chatter and warble of half a dozen varieties of wild birds. She had discovered a typist in Nilsprit who could speak Hebrew, and David took the tapes into her whenever he flew to town for supplies and to collect the mail, and he brought each batch of typing back with him for checking. They worked together on this task, David reading each batch of writing or correspondence aloud to her and making the alterations she asked for. He made it a habit of reading almost everything, from newspapers to novels, aloud. "Who needs Braille with you around?" Deborah remarked. But it was more than just the written word she needed to hear from him. It was each facet and dimension of her new surroundings. She had never seen any of the myriad birds that flocked to drink and bathe below her window, though she soon recognized each individual call and would pick out a stranger immediately. "David, there's a new one. What is it? What does it look like?" And he must describe not only its plumage, but its mannerisms and its habits. At other times, he must describe to her exactly how the new buildings fitted into their surroundings, the antics of Zulu the Labrador, and supply accurate descriptions of the servants, the view from the window of her workroom, and 100 other aspects of her new life. In time, the building was completed, and the strangers left Jabulani. But it was not until the crates from Israel, containing their furniture and other possessions from Malik Street, arrived, that Jabulani started truly to become their home. The olive wood table was placed under the window in the workroom. "I haven't been able to work properly. There was something missing." Deborah ran her fingers caressingly across the inlaid ivory and ebony top. "Until now?" Her books were in shelves on the wall beside the table, and the leather suite in the new lounge looked very well with the animal skin rugs and woven wool carpets. David hung the Ella Kadesh painting above the fireplace, Deborah determining the precise position for him by sense of touch. "Are you sure it shouldn't be a 1/16 of an inch higher?" David asked seriously. "Let's have no more lip from you, Morgan. I have to know exactly where it is." Then the great brass bedstead was set up in the bedroom and covered with the ivory-coloured bedspread. Deborah bounced up and down on it happily. "Now there's only one thing more that's missing," she declared. "What's that?" he asked with mock anxiety. "Is it something important?" "Come here," she crooked a finger in his general direction, "and I'll show you just how important it is." During the months of preparation, they had not left the immediate neighborhood of the homestead, but now, quite suddenly, the rush and bustle was over. "We have 18,000 acres and plenty of four-footed neighbors. Let's go check it all out," David suggested. They packed a cold lunch, and the three of them climbed into the new Land Rover with Zulu relegated to the back seat. The road led naturally down to the String of Pearls, for this was the focal point of all life upon the estate. They left the Land Rover amongst the fever trees and went down to the ruins of the thatched summer house on the bank of the main pool. The water aroused all Zulu's instincts, and he plunged into it, paddling out into the center with obvious enjoyment. The water was clear as air, but shaded to black in the depths. David scratched in the muddy bank and turned out a thick pink earthworm. He threw it into the shallows, and a dark shape half as long as his arm rushed silently out of the depths and swirled the surface. "Wow," David laughed. "There are still a few fat ones around. We'll have to bring down the rods. I used to spend days down here when I was a kid." The forest was filled with memories, and as they wandered along the edge of the reed banks, he reminisced about his childhood, until gradually he fell into silence, and she asked, "Is something wrong, David?" She had grown that sensitive to his moods. "There are no animals." His tone was puzzled. "Birds, yes, but we haven't seen a single animal, not even a duiker, since we left the homestead." He stopped at a place that was clear of reeds, where the bank shelved gently. This used to be a favorite drinking place. It was busy day and night, the herds virtually lining up for a chance to drink. He left Deborah and went down to the edge, stooping to examine the ground carefully. No spore even, just a few kudu, and a small troop of baboon. There's not been a herd here for months, or possibly years. When he came back to her, she asked gently, "You are upset?" "Jabulani without its animals is nothing," he muttered. "Come on, let's go and see the rest of it. There's something very odd here." The leisurely outing became a desperate hunt, as David scoured the thickets and the open glades, followed the dried watercourses, and stopped the Land Rover to examine the sand beds for signs of wildlife. Not even an impala. He was worried and anxious. There used to be thousands of them. I remember herds of them, silky brown and graceful as ballet dancers under nearly every tree. He turned the Land Rover northwards, following an overgrown track through the trees. There's grazing here that hasn't been touched. It's lush as a cultivated garden. A little before noon, they reached the dusty, corrugated public road that ran along the north boundary of Jabulani. The fence that followed the edge of the road was ruinous, with sagging and broken wire and many of the uprights snapped off at ground level. "Hell, it's a mess," David told her, as he turned through a gap in the wire onto the road and followed the boundary for 2 miles until they reached the turnoff to the Jabulani homestead. Even the signboard hanging above the stone pillars of the gateway, which David's father had fashioned in bronze and of which he had been so proud, was now dilapidated and hung askew. "Well, there's plenty of work to keep us going," said David with a certain relish. Half a mile beyond the gates, the road turned sharply, hedged on each side by tall grass, and standing full in the sandy track was a magnificent kudu bull, ghostly grey and striped with pale chalky lines across the deep, powerful body. His head was held high, armed with the long corkscrew black horns, and his huge ears were spread in an intent listening attitude. For only part of a second he posed like that. Then, although the Land Rover was still 200 yards off, he exploded into a smoky blur of frantic flight, his great horns laid along his back as he fled through the open bush in a series of long, lithe bounds, disappearing so swiftly it seemed he had been only a fantasy. And David described it to Deborah. "He took off the very instant he spotted us. I remember when they were so tame around here that we had to chase them out of the vegetable garden with sticks." Again he swung off the main track and onto another overgrown path, on which the new growth of saplings was already thick and tall. He drove straight over them in the tough little vehicle. "What on earth are you doing?" Deborah shouted above the crash and swish of branches. "In this country, when you run out of road, you just make your own." 4 miles further on, they emerged abruptly onto the firebreak track that marked the eastern boundary of Jabulani, the dividing line between them and the national park, which was larger than the entire land area of the State of Israel, 5 million acres of virgin wilderness, 385 kilometers long and 80 wide, home of more than 1 million wild animals, the most important reservoir of wildlife left in Africa. David stopped the Land Rover, cut the engine, and jumped down. After a moment of shocked and angry silence, he began to swear. "What's made you so happy?" Deborah demanded. "Look at that. Just look at that," David ranted. "I wish I could." "Oh, sorry, Debs. It's a fence. A game fence." It stood 8 feet high, and the uprights were hardwood poles thick as a man's thigh, while the mesh of the fence was heavy gauge wire. "They've fenced us off. The National Parks people have cut us off. No wonder there are no animals." As they drove back to the homestead, David explained to her how there had always been an open boundary with the Kruger National Park. It had suited everybody well enough, for Jabulani's sweet grazing and the perennial water of the pools helped to carry the herds through times of drought and scarcity. "It's becoming very important to you, this business of the wild animals." Deborah had listened silently, fondling the Labrador's head as David spoke. "Yes, suddenly it's important. When they were here, I guess I just took them for granted, but now they're gone, well, now they are very important."
He laughed abruptly and bitterly. I wonder how often that's been said in Africa. Now they're gone, it's suddenly important. They drove on for a mile or two without speaking, and then David said with determination, I'm going to get them to pull that fence out. They can't cut us off like that. I'm going to get hold of the head warden now, right away. David remembered Conrad Berg from his childhood, when he had been the warden in charge of the southern portion of the park, but not yet the chief. There was a body of legend about the man that had been built up over the years, and two of these stories showed clearly the type of man he was. Caught out in a lonely area of the reserve after dark with a broken-down truck, he was walking home when he was attacked by a full-grown male lion. In the struggle, he had been terribly mauled, half the flesh torn from his back and the bone of his shoulder and arm bitten through. Yet he had managed to kill the animal with a small sheath knife, stabbing it repeatedly in the throat until he hit the jugular. He had then stood up and walked 5 miles through the night with the hyena pack following him expectantly, waiting for him to drop. On another occasion, one of the estate owners bounding the park had poached one of Berg's lions, shooting it down half a mile inside the boundary. The poacher was a man high in government, wielding massive influence, and he had laughed at Conrad Berg. What are you going to do about it, my friend? Don't you like your job? Doggedly, ignoring the pressure from above, Berg had collected his evidence and issued a summons. The pressure had become less subtle as the court date approached, but he had never wavered. The important personage finally stood in the dock and was convicted. He was sentenced to £1,000 fine or 6 months at hard labour. Afterwards, he had shaken Berg's hand and said to him, Thank you for a lesson in courage. And perhaps this was one of the reasons Berg was now chief warden. He stood beside his game fence, where he had arranged over the telephone to meet David. He was a big man, broad and tall and beefy, with thick, heavily muscled arms still scarred from the lion attack, and a red sunburned face. He wore the suntans and slouch hat of the park service, with the green cloth badges on his epaulettes. Behind him was parked his brown Chevy truck, with the park board's emblem on the door, and two of his black game rangers seated in the back. One of them was holding a heavy rifle. Berg stood with his clenched fists on his hips, his hat pushed back, and a forbidding expression on his face. He so epitomized the truculent male animal guarding its territory that David muttered to Deborah, Here comes trouble. He parked close beside the fence, and he and Deborah climbed down and went to the wire.